Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about healthy cooking, about libraries, and about human rights in New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome David Carrasco. He is a historian of religion, and he's director of the Moses Mesoamerican Archive, both at Harvard University. He's co-editor of the book Cave, City, and Eagle's Nest, an interpretive journey through the Mapa de Cuautinchan, number 2. And he's giving a lecture at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium on Thursday, that's tonight, October 7th, from 6:30 to 7:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, it's great to be with you. I always like to talk to people in New Mexico and especially in Santa Fe.
Well, good. It's great to have you. Now, this object, this amazing thing, the Mapa de Cuautinchan, it's a vast work of history and art and symbolism. Just to describe to our listeners, what is it?
It's a it's an indigenous Mexican codex. That is to say, it's a huge sheet of paper upon which has been painted the epic journey of these ancient Mexican native peoples, starting in around 1300. And the story that is painted on this codex ends about the 1540s, 10 years after the Spaniards have arrived in Mexico.
Now, what do we know about its origins? Who made it and why?
Indigenous people, pre-Columbian people in Mexico, many communities had their own, their own epic stories and mythologies and their ancestral journeys painted on what we call codices or screen folds. And each community had one of these. It's kind of their local history or their local Bible. What they did is they basically recorded their origin story, the territory that they came from, the places that they passed through where they had ordeals or had religious experiences, and then each of them usually shows an arrival in their new community where they now exist and worship and live and raise their families. So this one was painted in the 1540s, but it's a copy of a pre-Columbian codex that this community had recorded their history on.
When you say it's a copy, how do we know that? And does the original that they were copying from still exist?
No, the original that they copied from no longer exists. The object itself, which I'll be talking about tonight, is a beautiful thing to look at. And first of all, it's got 700 symbols on it of this great journey. The journey begins in the cave, the seven caves of Aztlán, and it winds its way through a large part of Mexico, going by the volcanoes of Ixtaccíhuatl and Popocatépetl, down into Oaxaca, up into Veracruz, and eventually at their homeland. And the reason that we know it's a copy is because there's so much information on it that clearly comes and points to pre-Columbian knowledge. And we know that a number of these kinds of documents have survived from other parts of Mexico, that we clearly believe that it's a copy of a pre-Columbian document.
It's such a complex work that you and your collaborator have edited a massive book to its interpretation. And it's all pictures. It's also very much of a narrative. When you're in this process of looking at this thing, I mean, this was discovered by you and other scholars, so you had something which I think in scholarship, of course, is incredible, which is a fresh object to work on that's so very rich. How did you start? How did you know where the beginning was?
That's a great question, because it took us a while to figure that out. What happened was that here at Harvard University, they have the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies, and on the advisory board was a woman, a Mexican woman named Angeles Espinosa Iglesias, who was a wealthy banker who also was very concerned about taking care of indigenous Mexican objects. And she had come into possession of this codex, of this map, and she wanted to know if somebody at Harvard could read it. So she asked around. They said, well, maybe Professor Carrasco knows how to decipher the hieroglyphics on this map. And when I looked at it, I realized that there were parts of it I could, in fact, decipher, but there were parts I couldn't. But my archive, which you mentioned in the introduction, the Moses Mesoamerican Archive, there's a team of about 15 scholars who work with me in this archive from around the world. So I knew that we had the team of people who could read these hieroglyphics in terms of, for instance, Mary Charlotte, the botany on the map, as well as the animals who were on the map, the geography on the map, and the rituals on the map. So what I did is I assembled a team of these 15 scholars, and we spent 5 years reading these symbols of on this map and meeting and developing the interpretation that you find in the book that was published by the University of New Mexico Press.
And just to let people know, this is a very densely and intricately painted, I guess you would call it painting, which is a little bit bigger than 3 feet by 6 feet. So it's very large, and what's great about the book is it has a fold-up. It's published by University of New Mexico Press. It has this wonderful fold-out map that you can look at, but then in the pages of the book, it has close-ups of each little section that the different scholars are talking about, because it's so, I guess we'd just say daunting.
Well, you're right. It was daunting to us because of what you say. This map is quite large. It has these 700 colorful objects on it. It took us quite a while to figure out actually where the beginning, where the middle, where the end of the story is. But we were able to do that. And my co-editor is a real genius, a guy named Scott Sessions, who's at Amherst College. He came up with the idea that for the reader, for the person who purchased this book, we can really make it useful to them by having these 16 foldouts of sections of the map, and each foldout presents that part of the map in the actual size of the map. In other words, when you look at it, at one of those foldouts, you're actually seeing that part of the map in the actual size of the objects.
Right.
I mean, of the images of the objects. So it really puts the reader in touch with the map itself.
Now, I would think that in order to interpret a work like this, it would be necessary to open oneself to different ways of viewing things, like space and time and stories, that for the indigenous people who made this mapa, this painting, were really different from our own. And I wondered what that journey of seeing things through indigenous eyes, or trying to do that, was like for you.
It was sort of a revelation every month. We spent several years just trying to figure out the orientation on the map, and I'd come in some mornings and I'd see objects or images I had never seen before. I was like as though someone had come in the night and painted them there, but of course they'd always been there. But it's as you say, it's such a rich, detailed part of the map. When I compare this mapa to having a Mexican Iliad or an Odyssey, because what you come to know in terms of your question, when you learn from indigenous people today or you read through the indigenous record of the 16th century, you know that every one of these images has a story associated with it. So there's hundreds of stories that are linked together that were used to direct the painters of the map. And what we had to do was to get into the story, into the indigenous story. And as a historian of religions, I've learned some things from indigenous people about how they tell stories. We were able, in a sense, to some degree, enter into the storytelling mode of the people who painted the map, as well as using our interpretive tools from the 21st century of how to interpret objects from the outside.
Now, how is their storytelling mode unique or different from our own?
Well, you know, it's actually, I think all humans to have stories tend to share a certain kind of, you know, beginning, middle, and end of the story. But for these people who are who represent a really a pre-Hispanic mode of storytelling, there's a great deal of emphasis on ancestors, on places of beginning, which they tend to value a great deal. And for instance, in the map, when you look at the Mapa de Cuauhtinchan, by the way, the word Cuauhtinchan means the place of the eagle's nest, which was the name of the town where this was painted. The painters were from the place of the eagle's nest. But the place of the eagle's nest, the people, came from a location that's quite popular, you know, among some people in New Mexico who identify themselves as Mexican or Hispanic. And that is, the map really starts in Aztlan. It starts in the place of seven caves where the ancestors have been living and guarding the hearts and the seeds of the people. And there's a great deal of emphasis on this ancestral land, that it's highly valued. And it's one of the biggest images on the whole map is this place of seven caves up in the left-hand corner. And so the stories, the storytelling mode is always to value those ancestors, give them priority of place and story, but also, secondly, talk about how when the ancestors come out of the caves and make their way through the world, they're always interacting with deities, with spirits, with supernatural entities. And those, the relationship between the human and the supernatural, it never ends, it never stops. It shows up periodically throughout the journey, and therefore makes it this kind of fascinating thing to look at. I think that's a second kind of storytelling characteristic that you see.
The kinds of things that you're talking about, this relationship with the ancestors and the deities that you find in the storytelling in this mapa, how do they relate to the ways of thinking of the indigenous and mestizo descendants of the people who made this painting?
Well, the people that made this painting they were born before the Spaniards came, but they are painting it after the Spaniards have arrived. And one of the things that's very interesting about this codex is that even though it's painted in the time of Spaniards, there's not a single Spaniard on the map. It's really them telling our story. They're telling their story, and they're making sure that the protagonists and the narrative and the events and the places are seen and appreciated in a non-European way. It's interesting that when you look at the map closely, you'll notice there are two European buildings on the map. There's two churches. There's two Christian churches there, but there's no Spaniards that appear. So these people are, as opposed to some other documents that were painted at the same time in other parts of Mexico that did show Spaniards, and native peoples acting together. This is clearly an indigenous story. What they're saying is, this is about us. We are the protagonists, and we want to make sure our children now, in the 1540s and 50s, we want to make sure they know our story. And I think that's one of the real powerful messages of this document, that even though these people, some of them were undoubtedly Christians, some of them undoubtedly knew how to write in European languages, they decided to keep the indigenous Native American mode as their way of being.
Do you think that they did that in part because the potential threat from the Spanish cultural and military influence was so close to them?
I do. I think that's a good question. I think they're very aware of the pressures that they're under in this community. So, for instance, we know that this same community painted a series of these kinds of documents. But the painters of this document really kept to the indigenous story. Some of the others, which are not as beautiful, would not have been painted by the same painters. They would have been painted by, you know, other villages. Some of the others were more open to narrating the Spanish presence. In relation to your question, this community was one of the places where one of the earliest churches, Christian churches, were built in this community. So there was clearly Spanish presence that they were aware of, and there's no doubt in my mind they were defending themselves in part by painting this story and then defending it. You know, you may be interesting for your listeners to know that this document was kept and protected in the community, and no European, as far as we know, or no Mexican ever saw it until the 1730s when a count came from Italy through Spain and heard about this particular document, and he wrote about it in his diary that he came to the town, that he tried to buy this from the people, and they wouldn't let him. They told him no. He wrote down about this document, and that's how we know that it was known, that outsiders tried to get hold of it, and these people wanted to protect it.
It's amazing that it stood the ravages of time and survived the conquest and all of that in a world where so many books were burned and so much cultural documentation was lost.
That's an excellent point, because we can't emphasize enough for our listeners how aggressive the Catholic Church and the Spanish officials were in trying to destroy evidence of the indigenous record, indigenous culture, and especially its religious practices. There were literally bonfires in the communities of New Spain where they would assemble huge numbers of these types of documents, bring the people out, and especially the priests and the shamans, and have them watch these documents go up in flames. And so here's a community that certainly saw this and knew this. They protected this. And your listeners will be interested to know that there's another point where Europeans become aware of this and go after it, and that is in 1892, when Spain was about to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's landfall in the New World. They had a big exhibition in Spain, and they the year before, an academic journal had come out that referenced this map. Therefore, Spain sent representatives to the town of Cuautinchan to see if they could get it and bring it to Spain to exhibit during this big show. And we know that the indigenous people said, no, you can't take it, but they allowed them to make a copy. An artist named Bello came, made a copy of this, and the copy went to Spain. And therefore, more people in Europe knew about it, but the original stayed in this town, protected by the elders, really until the 1930s.
We're talking to David Carrasco, historian of religion at Harvard University. So there you are with a number of other scholars all looking at this object. You are in a university in New England. How important was it to go to Mexico to be there in order to gain insight into this document?
Oh, it's absolutely essential. Really, we couldn't do it. We did take the whole group to Mexico, to Puebla, for an academic meeting, and we also went out into the community to look at places in the landscape today that are referenced in the MAPA, the Cuautinchan. We talked to people from the town, the descendants of the owners of this map, the makers of this map, and we even had a very fine young scholar from Harvard who went down there and spent months studying with these people and doing an archaeological examination of the pottery and the ruins associated with the map. Her name is Anne Zifarelli Valencia. Wrote a beautiful dissertation and who has an article in the MAPA itself. So we went, we looked at the MAPA, and when you see the MAPA in real life, you know immediately that you are in the presence of a sacred creation of these people, the beauty of it, the finery of it, the artistry of it, and you have a feeling when you're around it, that it's like a shroud or something that has a kind of saturation of the sacred, and it leaves you kind of speechless. So being there in the land where the people created it was very important to us, and it's just absolutely essential to see the landscape that is represented in the MAPA, the Cuautinchan.
Where in Mexico are we talking about?
We're talking about the state of Puebla. This is just east of the volcanoes, the Iztaccíhuatl and the Popocatépetl, near the sacred city of Cholula. So it's about an hour and a half, 2 hours by car from Mexico City, directly east.
And where is the MAPA right now?
The MAPA right now is actually in the home of family that owns this map, and it's related to a foundation in Mexico called the Fundación Amparo, which is a very wealthy foundation that does a lot to develop and promote the cultural practices of Mexico. There's a museum in Puebla called the Museo Amparo that has many pre-Columbian and colonial artifacts. That's the family that owns this, and the MAPA has its own room where it's in a climate-controlled case and a climate-controlled room, and I think there are discussions about having an exhibit. When I talk about this tonight here in Santa Fe, I'm going to compare it to it's like having a Dead Sea Scroll or, you know, one of the Gnostic Gospels where you have something made by the hands of people who were in touch with, you know, their truths in very profound ways and decided to narrate it in this colorful, pictorial fashion so that they would have a basis for further oral storytelling and really contains the most sacred meanings and truths of these families, this land, and this community.
So you, after years of research and the publication of this beautiful, grand book, what's your relationship now to the Mapa de Cuautitlán? Are you still exploring it? Are you kind of done?
Oh, no, it's an unending kind of journey, just like if you had the Iliad or the Odyssey and you translated it, you'd always go back and retranslate and relook at things. But right now we're hoping that the University of New Mexico Press is about to publish a Spanish edition. We've done a Spanish translation of this, and through the work of Scott Sessions, we've been able to sort of fit everything in the same pagination, and it's going to be a stunning Spanish-language version of this. The book, when it came out in English, won the gold medal for the best designed book from the Publishers of the West, and I'm sure that the Spanish edition. But to focus again on your question, we were just at the beginning, and I think that a new generation of scholars and students can get this book, they can open up those pages, they can read the different articles, and they can provide us with new interpretations. Some will be different than ours, some will be better than ours. So we've just really laid the foundation. And one of the really great things about this book is that, you know, it looks at the MAPA from all these different angles. One of the most popular essays is by a former student of mine, Vincent Stanzioni, and the title of the essay is Walking is Knowing. And Stanzioni lives in the Maya highlands with indigenous Maya peoples, and he walks all over the highlands with them in their rituals. And so when he saw this, he said, look, I know what these footprints on the map mean. And he talks about what it's like to know things by walking, by pilgrimage. And I think that we're on a pilgrimage, and we have new people to join the pilgrimage in the interpretation of this very rare, beautiful, but very important Mesoamerican codex.
David Carrasco is historian of religion at Harvard University and director of the Moses Mesoamerican Archive there. And he is co-author of this wonderful book, Cave, City, and Eagle's Nest, an interpretive journey through the Mapa de Cuautitlán, number 2. And once again, he will be at the New Mexico History Museum tonight at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great to be with you, and I look forward to talking with people tonight.
Excellent. I'd like now to welcome John Doc Willoughby. He is the executive director of the America's Test Kitchen Cookbooks, and he will be discussing and signing the new book in the series. It's called The America's Test Kitchen Healthy Family Cookbook, tonight, October 7th at 5 o'clock at the Inn and Spa at Loretto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
So what is America's Test Kitchen?
Well, America's Test Kitchen is an actual test kitchen in Brookline, Massachusetts, where the test cooks work for Cooks Illustrated Magazine, Cooks Country Magazine, and the America's Test Kitchen show, a TV show, as well as a series of books. So we have 40 full-time test cooks in the kitchen working on recipes for the various magazines and also for this series of books, of which the Healthy Family Cookbook is the latest one.
That must be nice work if you can get it, testing and creating recipes.
I think it is. It's not. There are some drawbacks to it because the way that they work in the test kitchen is they take a recipe, let's say mashed potatoes, and we tend to stick to sort of, you know, mainstream recipes, and they test it sometimes 60, 65 times looking for the perfect way to make mashed potatoes. So it can get somewhat repetitive, but it is a kind of discovery process, and if you love cooking, there's really nothing better than that. And so for this book, we took that same process and we added in making the recipes healthy. And what we mean by that is not like they're not like diet food, but we did make a whole book of over 800 recipes that if you ate exclusively from this book, you would be eating healthily, but you'd be eating foods that you like, not strange foods, not you wouldn't feel deprived, but your diet would be healthy if you ate just from this book.
You know, from what I've been reading and the Michael Pollan stuff and all of that, just if you make your own food at all, you're a step ahead of the rest of the country.
Absolutely. If you did a top 10 ways to eat more healthily, that would be number one. Because cooking at home, you simply have much more control over what you put in your food. And, you know, I love restaurants and restaurant foods, but one of the reasons they taste so good is because they use a ton of, you know, butter and cream and meat and all the things that aren't so healthy for you. So just cooking at home is a huge step in the right direction.
So the book seems to have as its underlying theme that we're all eating too much fat or are in danger of doing so. But then again, there's different kinds of fat. I've often felt that butter is more healthy than margarine because you know what you're getting, and margarine is a factory product full of Lord knows what.
Yeah, it's true. Butter is much better than margarine because margarine is full of trans fats, which is a very bad thing to be eating. So we use butter in the book because it has an amazing flavor. You love the butter flavor. We just try to use it only as a flavoring in the smallest amounts that you could use it and still, you know, have the flavor but not have as many calories. You know, if you just pay some attention to the kind of fat you're using, if you're using oil, for example, if you use olive oil, you know, it's got a great flavor. It's great in a vinaigrette or to drizzle on a soup. But for sort of everyday cooking, if you just use canola oil instead of olive oil, you're going to cut the fat and saturated fats in the oil by 50%. So there are a lot of little things like that that if you just know about them, they're not that hard to do, and they really do reduce the amount of fat and calories in your diet.
What is your take on organic and locally grown foods compared to factory farmed and produced foods, both in terms of health and in terms of taste?
Well, we years ago at the old Cooks magazine, we did a testing of a blind testing of organic and non-organic vegetables, and the organic won every time. So they do taste better, and locally is, you know, local food is much better for the economy. There are a lot of reasons to eat it, in addition to the fact that it generally seems to taste better. Issues of price, you know, are still being resolved because for a lot of people, organic food is still more expensive than they can afford, and local food often isn't, but it's hard to come by in some places. But generally speaking, if you can put organic food and local food into your diet whenever possible, that's a good thing.
So how is this book different, and how are the recipes different from the previous books in the America's Test Kitchen series? Is it kind of like the same thing, just less fat, or is it different in other ways?
Well, we have three approaches to the recipe. Some of them are makeovers where we took a traditional comfort food, which are usually called comfort food because they have a lot of fat, and we redid them so that they still tasted great but had less fat and less calories. Then there's a whole category of other dishes in the book which are naturally healthy. So they're grains and whole grains and fruits and vegetables and some that you might not have thought of. For example, a farro risotto, which is something that a lot of people might not have thought of, but it's super healthy, it's very easy, and, you know, you're not going to feel deprived by eating it. So there are the ones that we've made over, and then there's a whole new group of foods that we're sort of introducing to our readers.
One thing that I've found with comfort foods is some of the things that used to be my comfort foods aren't anymore. For example, the cinnamon sugar frosted Pop-Tarts, which I used to just love. Now they make me feel queasy.
It's interesting. When you start eating a little bit less fat and a little bit less sugar in your diet, you go back to the things that you thought were so awesome, so great when you were a kid, and that you can't eat them. They have too much fat, too much sugar, too much grease, and they don't make you feel good. So as you sort of start working into this everyday diet of you know, less fat and somewhat less calories and sugar, you get used to it and you like it better. And so when you just don't want to go back to the unhealthy foods that you used to think were so great.
What are some of your own favorites from the new book?
Well, one of my favorites is, oddly enough, Santa Fe meatloaf, which is, I love it because it's a great meatloaf. It has about 50% less fat than a traditional one, and it also incorporates a lot of strong flavors, which is another really good thing to do when you're cutting out fat. It uses chipotles and chili peppers and bell peppers and corn and black beans. In this meatloaf, it makes it more interesting, it has a higher texture, and it also, you know, is much better for you, but it still tastes great. So that's one of my favorites. I also have to admit, I'm a big dessert person, so I really like a lot of the desserts because there's a light and fluffy chocolate mousse in there, for example, which I love because I love chocolate mousse, but it uses no whipped cream. It uses an Italian meringue, which is a sugar syrup whipped into egg whites, so you get that creaminess and that frothiness that you love in chocolate mousse, but it's got many less calories. So I'm a sucker for the sort of dessert makeovers.
One wonders, I mean, one has suspicions, or at least I have suspicions with the dessert makeovers, that they're not going to taste good, or that, I mean, fat really does make things taste better, by and large.
Fat is a great carrier of flavor. And so what we wanted to do, because the number one principle for this book was that the food has to taste great. Because if it doesn't taste good, it doesn't matter how healthy it is, because no one wants to eat it. So, you know, it's useless then. So what we did was we didn't remove all the fat from any of the desserts. We just left enough fat to carry the flavor, to bolster the flavor, and we found other ways in many of the desserts of giving that sort of creamy mouthfeel that you usually get from fats, from lower-fat products. But we did use some, you know, lower-fat products, but we found that you couldn't go all the way. For example, we could never use low-fat cheddar cheese. We could use medium-fat cheddar cheese, but the low-fat just didn't taste good. So a tremendous amount of work on the part of the test cooks went into figuring out just what was the point to stop in reducing the fat so it still really tasted good. Because I agree with you. When I hear low-fat desserts, I think, nah, not interested. But these really work.
Now, you don't make us eat carob, do you?
Yes, there's a carrot puree in there, which is a Moroccan carrot puree, which is very delicious. Came from a restaurant.
Excellent. John, also known as Doc Willoughby, is the executive editor of the America's Test Kitchen Cookbook, and he will be talking about the new book in the series, The America's Test Kitchen Healthy Family Cookbook, which is a very easy-to-use cookbook the way it's set up, and it's kind of a binder, so you can move pages around. And that's tonight at 5 o'clock at the Inn and Spa at Loretto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
I'm very happy to welcome to the program right now librarians Kitty Sherlock and Alana McGrattan. Kitty is vice chair of the State Bonds for Libraries PAC, and Alana is co-president of the Friends of the Santa Fe Public Library, and she's on the board of the Santa Fe Women's Club and Library Association, which was the original founder over 100 years ago of the Santa Fe Public Library.
That's correct. In 1896, the literacy rate in Santa Fe was 78%, and a group of civic-minded women got together at Mrs. Haroon's house and decided that there were many things that needed to happen to deal with these problems, and one would be to start a library, which they did. And the building they got the money for from the legislature, the first library in Santa Fe, was 1906.
So there are, I mean, we've done programs before on the libraries, but there are some facts about libraries which I did not know, which is that tens of thousands of people go through the front door of the New Mexico Public Library system every single day and check out even more books and movies and other materials.
And actually, the statistics in Santa Fe have increased because of the economic challenges that people are facing. The computer usage is up 14%, circulation is up 17%, and not related necessarily to the economy, but last summer, children in Santa Fe in the summer reading program read over 15,000 books last summer.
Do we have any idea how many books per child that is?
Well, if you get a calculator, this past summer, it was 975 children divided by 15,000 books.
Okay, well, that gives you an idea. And, of course, it's a small number of children who are the big readers, and probably the three of us sitting at this table were those kids when we were small.
Uh-huh, that's right.
On the November 2nd election, among many other choices that we have for our elected officials, there's a library bond.
That's correct. It's bond B. It's at the very end of the ballot. All the bonds are at the end of the ballot. And it's a request for $7.1 million to be in a bond. And that funding will go to public school, tribal, and college libraries. And it will be for materials, equipment, software, all the things that people can make collections from, you know.
Right. And how are those libraries doing now? In other words, what's the need for the bond?
It depends on the particular library. The public libraries, this is a major support source for them. The college libraries, it supports about 25% of what they need. And the school libraries, it is the total budget for school libraries for materials. In the past 5 years, many of the school districts have just dropped providing materials in their budget. They still pay for staff, but not materials.
What do you mean by materials?
Books, CDs, audiovisual, internet, any kind of subscriptions, both electronic and magazine or newspaper subscriptions.
In Santa Fe in particular, we have a new program that people are using and are very excited about called Mango. And this is a program the public library provides, and all you need is a library card, and you can go online, and you can learn 23 different foreign languages through this program that's provided by the Santa Fe Public Library. That is another example of the kind of thing that the bond money would support.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Are people also using it to learn English as a second language?
That's another aspect of Mango. There's also a whole other module for ESL, English as a second language.
It seemed at one point that libraries were going to be redundant and unnecessary because everybody was doing stuff at home and nobody reads books anymore and everybody is using their Kindles and reading stuff online. It's the opposite that's really happened.
Yes, it's caused greater publishing, in fact, greater book publishing, having the whole wave of computers. And libraries are one of the main places people can get access to computers also.
And a lot of people there are librarians who have told us that they end up having to be kind of like career counselors because people come to the libraries to use the computers to apply for jobs and make resumes and that kind of thing.
That's right. It's heavily used by low-income people who don't have any other computer access. Also, in applying for grants, applying for financial support, that has been all those types of applications are now on computer. You have to go to a computer to do them.
Right. The days of sending your resume in the mail are probably long gone.
Right.
And you have to also have an email address to apply for a job.
Right.
And that's part of the service the public library offers to patrons, is the basic computer skills and setting up email addresses for patrons.
So when people talk about, should I vote for a bond or not, what is at stake financially for individuals, for families in New Mexico?
The cost of this bond, it's, I think, one of the two cheapest bonds that are on the bond list. And it is actually 45 cents that will be taxed to a person who owns $100,000 worth of property. So it'll go into a tax. And it will be, so for every $100,000 of property that is assessed, and that you own, you will pay 45 whole cents for this.
So if I live in a $200,000 house, let's say, or it's worth that now, I pay a whopping 90 cents?
That's
right. Actually, you'd pay less, because if you lived in a home that was worth $200,000, it would, the property tax assessment value would be somewhere around $100,000.
Right.
So it's not the real value, it's the assessed
value. Right, but in other words, it's pocket change over the course of a year. It's really negligible, because that's what people worry about when they vote for supposedly new issues of this kind.
Right, is it going to mess up their
budget? It's like the cost of a stamp.
Yeah, it's the cost of a couple of stamps. Stamps, what are they? haven't used those in a while either. Now, what else do you want people to know about libraries and about this bond?
Well, I would like to put in a little bit more about school libraries. We have had school libraries dependably since the 60s, since the War on Poverty. That's when a major funding happened, which caused the whole publishing industry for children's books to really come alive. And before that time, most people had no, who were working on either writing or illustrating children's books, really didn't have much market at all. So this is what created a giant market. And so we have had that market ever since. School libraries are usually the main place where kids can choose anything they want to read. And that has been one of the basic factors in reading, is that you're reading stuff you want to read about.
Yeah,
so we're finding that out more and more. Kids are motivated by the topic.
I have a friend who actually, years ago, she was an English teacher, and then she kind of took a break and then decided that she was going to go back and instead of teaching, be a school librarian. Mm-hmm. And that is an incredibly powerful and fulfilling, at least the way she was talking about it, fulfilling position, because you get to meet all these kids and recommend things by getting to know them and seeing what they might like and all of that. And she got all kinds of kids reading.
Right. That's true. It's very exciting. The other big area, too, that librarians, school librarians work in is teaching kids to be critical about what they're reading or what they're watching or what they're reading on the Internet, to get what they call information literate, to become media literate and information literate. So they're looking at not only the date of the authorship of an entry or the bias of a program. It's where so kids can be able to think through that instead of just swallowing everything whole.
Which makes them an incredibly important part of the democratic process.
Right. Uh-huh.
And one of the things, too, in information literacy is the whole issue of media literacy. Right now we're going through a campaign here in New Mexico, a political campaign that has a lot of things being alleged on either side by both parties about the opposing candidates. How does a person in a democratic system take that information and really deconstruct it and make sense out of it so that they can vote intelligently and understand what's being presented? And so part of what students are also learning in school is the whole issue of media literacy and how they're a market that's targeted and the information they're getting has to do with somebody wanting something from them, whether it's their money to buy something or whether it's their vote.
Right. One other kind of libraries, too, I think that we should talk about is tribal. That this, for the last two elections, we have had, the bond has included coverage of public libraries, tribal public libraries, and they have really focused on preservation of culture and language. And so I feel like that's another aspect of libraries, but especially the tribal libraries, that they're focused on continuing their culture.
Kitty Sherlock and Alana McGrattan are lifelong, I guess you'd say, librarians, and they are here to encourage all of us to vote yes on Bond Issue B on November 2nd. And of course, there's early voting, so people can be voting right now.
That's correct.
Well, thank you both so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Alana Offield. She is the Student Activism Coordinator with Amnesty International New Mexico, and there is a conference happening at the University of New Mexico this coming Saturday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
So what's happening this weekend?
Well, this weekend, it's been about 2 years in the making. We're having New Mexico, Amnesty International New Mexico's first ever student activist training. And the idea is to provide workshops on issues of human rights issues that are specific to New Mexico, as well as provide some leadership training and activist building for students in New Mexico, just kind of aiming to give them a voice and to get them inspired to do activist work, both in their campuses and in their communities, too.
What are some of the human rights issues that affect New Mexicans?
Well, there's definitely lots of issues around immigration. That's kind of the big one with all the things that were happening in Arizona this past summer. Lots of the students that we've talked to with Amnesty International, that's what they want to start organizing around, and they want to make sure that New Mexico doesn't adopt the same laws that Arizona attempted to. And there's also lots of issues around equal marriage equality rights, and we'll be working on some of that as well in conjunction with the ACLU.
The people who oppose immigration reform of any kind don't really see it as a human rights issue. Explain how it is a human rights issue to you.
Immigration is a human rights issue because if you think back through history, originally immigrants in this country were treated very badly, and then eventually they were able to assimilate with the birth of suburbanization. And we've reached a point now where people are afraid to talk about the race issues around human rights, but we see those race issues as important. Knowing that a lot of what's not being said around immigration is about race and about fear of people that are different from us, be that through skin color or culture. And Amnesty International wants to build a global community, and we understand that immigration is a natural part of any country, and that we need reform to make sure that all the immigration laws that we enact have nothing to do with race or culture.
I think another human rights issue around immigration is the, first of all, the division of families when some of them have different legal status than others, or when children come home to find no parents because their parents have been deported, things like that. And also the deportation of people who really grew up in this country since they were 2 years old and have no homeland to go back to, and yet they're sent away. I mean, those are horrible cases and very destructive.
They are, and Amnesty released a report a few years back called Jailed Without Detention, Jailed Without Justice, sorry, and that was around immigrant detention, and a lot of what they looked at was cases of children being separated from their families, and even cases of American citizens that were put into ICE detention centers because, you know, their English wasn't that well, and they get picked up, and they can't provide the proper documents, but they are actually citizens of this country, and there were several cases of people that spent weeks, even months, in detention centers whenever they were citizens separated from their family.
So if people want to get in touch with you, is this open to only college students, or who can actually go to this this workshop happening this weekend?
It's university and high school level students, and we've got both age groups coming now. And so we welcome anyone, even if your school doesn't have an Amnesty International group. If you're interested in social justice activism and learning some of the leadership skills that go along with it, we're more than happy to welcome anyone.
Alana Offield is Student Activism Coordinator with Amnesty International New Mexico. What is a contact number and or website that people can reach you at?
Well, people can call me directly on my cell phone, which is 325-280-2559, or you can email me at Alana Offield, ALANNAOFFIELD, at yahoo.com, and I can send you on a link to the registration form. And if you want more information about Amnesty International, you can go to www.aiusa.org.
And if anybody's missed any of that, you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Alana, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You could subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.